Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Listen, I know San Francisco is a single city sticking out there in our beautiful bay, but any honest reading of this place also indicates that San Francisco is the center of a much bigger, broader region. For more than 150 years, people from up in the Delta to far south of the official city boundaries have needed to get up to and around the City of Hills. The transit systems that schemers and civic officials put into place shaped nearly everything about the Bay Area that we love and sometimes hate, as depicted in a new documentary, Moving San Francisco, premiering tonight on KQED. Today, we'll talk all things city transit, mobility, equity, and the woman who foreshadowed Rosa Parks by a century. That's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. As the author Gary Camilla tells us in the new documentary, Moving San Francisco, at its peak in the pre-Bay Bridge 20th century, the Ferry Building was the second busiest transit station in the world, trailing only London's Charing Crossing. As that indicates, San Francisco has long been a crossroads of its region, of California, of the United States, and really of the entire globe. The systems that were developed to move people around shaped this place in ways that are so deep, it's hard to see them. So we have a panel for you today to excavate the undergirding of this region and reveal the hidden guide wires of the San Francisco Bay Area. Joining us now is Peter Stein, the co-director, producer, and writer of Moving San Francisco. Welcome to the show, Peter.
It's great to be here. Nice to see you. Nice to hear you, Alexis. Yes.
We'll see each other someday. Yeah. We're also joined by Gary Camilla, the host of Moving San Francisco. He's also the author of Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, and Spirits of San Francisco, Voyages Through the Unknown City. Welcome to the show, Gary.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. Great to hear from you. And we're also joined by Jeffrey Tumlin, Director of Transportation for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, or SFMTA, and also a major part of this big documentary. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Good morning.
Jeffrey, I want to start with a cut from the documentary that features you. Let's just listen in.
But from the get-go, the streets of San Francisco, laid out by early engineers in a rational grid, have been at war with the landscape.
Part of the magic of San Francisco is the absurdity of applying an orthogonal grid atop crazy topography.
So Jeffrey, tell me what you meant by this magic and this absurdity of applying an orthogonal grid atop crazy topography.
Well, San Francisco was laid out so quickly, just before its biggest boom, and nobody really had any time to lay out a rational street system. So Jasper O'Farrell, who was 26 years old at the time, just applied straight streets across the city's topography. And the result of that is the continual unexpected surprise of these long vistas down to the water, through the fog, across the bay. It's, you know, wandering around San Francisco on foot, it's always unexpectedly breathtaking, and we owe that to surveying sloppiness in the early 19th century.
Wait, so how would that normally have been done then? Like if it had been done in a more rational, less magical way, what would have happened?
Well, so normally you wouldn't have streets that run up 25% grades. So rather than having streets that just bound over Telegraph Hill and up and over Knob Hill, you'd follow the contours. You know, streets in cities evolve typically really slowly, following literally cattle tracks. And we have one example of that, which is Columbus Avenue. But for the most part, the streets in San Francisco just completely ignore the reality of the city.
I love Columbus Avenue, so that really reinforces that for me. Jeffrey Stein, you know, any visitor to San Francisco can take a look at a map for 30 seconds and know that Market Street is special without necessarily knowing why. Do you yourself also, you know, having made this, do you just see Market Street as an amazing part of the city?
Well, I think what's this is Peter Stein, and I want to say that just as a compliment
Peter,
to
my
colleague. No, it's fine. Jeffrey Tumlin, who not only runs a major agency in San Francisco, but is an amazing historian of San Francisco Transit as well. When my colleague Jim Yeager and I set out to make the film, we did feel that it's not just about the transit systems and the, you know, the magical history of the cable cars and so forth, but it really, we wanted to look at the very underlying grid of the San Francisco streets to figure out what is it that makes this city unusual. So not only do we take a look at that strange topography that has seen this rational grid laid on top of this terrain, but Market Street itself, which was designed by Jasper O'Farrell to kind of reconcile two competing grids in the early part of the city, one that goes basically north-south, what we now think of as sort of downtown and the marina, and one that goes sort of diagonal, orthogonal to that, south of Market. And Jasper O'Farrell laid out this enormous 120-foot wide boulevard in a city that was still basically, as one of our subjects says in the film, alleys and tiny streets. And the development of Market Street as a major boulevard was transformative in the future of what we think of now as the entire downtown. It's a very long run. It's a gentle grade. And as Jeff Tumlin states in the film, that long run and that gentle grade has determined almost all of the development patterns of the city. And that was one of where the major neighborhoods are, where the streetcar lines go that radiate from Market Street, where we ended up putting BART and Muni underground. And now in this latest experiment, where we have now barred vehicles from other than sort of, you know, commercial and transit vehicles, but barred private vehicles from using Market Street in the downtown area, Market Street becomes this kind of proving ground for what it means to move people effectively and efficiently around the city. And that's what we try to do in the film, is try to peel back some of those taken for granted layers and say, well, how did we get here? And what does it mean for how people use a city?
Yeah, and it works. I mean, I've always wondered why Market Street worked exactly the way that it did. And that explanation of sort of rectifying the two grids and also the grading of that particular street. And suddenly the whole city's infrastructure is kind of revealed. Gary Camille, I want to play a cut of you in the cable car barn. And the reason is, I feel like this is the other thing that people think of when they think of San Francisco Transit. You know, they think like, oh, this amazing technology. So let's listen in to a cut from the documentary Moving San Francisco.
This is the powerhouse of the San Francisco cable car barn, the heart and soul of the system. This system is an intricate Rube Goldberg-like contraption with 2,400 moving parts and ample opportunity for things to go wrong. They really have mastered a 19th century technology that is essentially unchanged since Andrew Hallady invented it in 1873.
Oh man, so many interesting things that you said in just a 30-second cut there. But first, is it fair to say that cable cars are your favorite form of San Francisco transit?
Yeah, I mean, they're unique. Lucius Beebe said that they were the most intimate, beloved form of personal transportation ever invented. They're magical. Even though they're a cliche and they're almost become sort of a postcard image of San Francisco, they're just unbeatable. They're my favorite in that way. They're certainly not my favorite in terms of something that I practically use to get around. You know, yeah. It's a very few. There's a few people, San Franciscan residents who take the California Street line, who live in Pacific Heights and go down to downtown to work. That's probably one of the few lines that actually functions practically if you're a San Franciscan. Otherwise, you take them as a extremely expensive local transit thrill ride. You know, it's almost a Disneyland kind of experience. But no, they're wonderful.
I mean, one of the things I love about it is it kind of shows the city is this sort of palimpsest of like different transit technologies and eras. And the other really significant one of those, Gary, is the ferries. You know, this sort of, which seem both, you know, retro in a sense, because we know that they were much more popular before we had the Bay Bridge, but they're still an amazing way of getting around the city.
Oh, absolutely. And I think anyone who wasn't, you know, around in the 1930s and 40s and even earlier in their heyday can't help but feel a great nostalgia and a sense of regret that, you know, you weren't around when they were the way that you came to what at that time was called the front door. The Embarcadero, which was called East Street, was called San Francisco's front door. That was the way you came into the city, was by water. And people made lifelong friends on the ferries. They really fell in love with that mode of coming into San Francisco, and millions of people did it. And they're still an incredibly wonderful way to get around, and it puts you in touch with the Bay, the dominant, you know, geographical feature of San Francisco. So, you know, I'd love to see the ferries get even more robust. They're a wonderful way of moving around.
You know, Jeffrey Tumlin, sometimes it seems as if the transit system that we ended up with was somewhat inevitable, you know, as a result of technological change or the city's growth. Do you see it that way? Or do you think that the system we ended up with was sort of more or less accidental?
Well, I think it's a combination of fortuitous accident and good planning. But it's also a combination of that tight relationship between land use and transit. Every single neighborhood commercial district in San Francisco is there because that's where the streetcars or cable cars used to run. And so the land use pattern of the city reinforces the underlying pattern of historic transit expansion.
Yeah. You know, Peter Stein, one of the big issues raised by your film is exactly this kind of real estate transit nexus. As we go into the break, what do you think you learned from making this documentary about that nexus, that relationship?
Well, I think when Jim Yeager and I began making the film, we just presumed it was going to be kind of in some ways, a celebration of the history of the how people got around, some of the wonderful technologies like the cable car, and then looking as to why we have so many transit problems now and figuring how we're going to innovate our way out of it. But what we learned quickly was, in fact, that transit didn't really respond to the needs of the city. Transit caused the needs of the city. The fact that cable car lines and streetcar lines were privately owned, often by people who were developing great stretches of the city, meant that, in fact, the reason that we even have certain neighborhoods at all or certain commercial districts is because the transit was planned to go there. And that happens over and over again. East Bay cities expanded because the ferries were going there in the years before the bridges. We've seen that with the suburbs aided by the commuter travel enabled by BART. So that's, I think, was the big takeaway for us in making the film, is transit actually is the driver and not simply the passenger of urban development.
We're talking about the new documentary, Moving San Francisco, which premieres tonight on KQED TV at 9 p.m. with Peter Stein, co-director, producer, and writer of Moving San Francisco, Gary Camilla, who hosts the documentary, and Jeffrey Tumlin, director of transportation for SFMTA. Stay tuned for more Forum after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the new documentary, Moving San Francisco, about the city's past and present modes of transportation, with Peter Stein, co-director, producer, and writer of Moving San Francisco, which premieres tonight on KQED at 9 p.m. We also have Gary Camilla, who hosted the documentary. He's the author of Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, and Spirits of San Francisco, Voyages Through the Unknown City. We're also joined by Jeffrey Tumlin, director of transportation with SFMTA. We want to know, what questions do you have about San Francisco's transit history, and we're about to talk about some on-the-ground activism. And so we're curious, were you involved with the so-called freeway revolt? Or do you remember when they took down the Embarcadero Freeway or the Cypress structure in West Oakland? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or you can email your questions or comments about San Francisco transit to forum@kqed.org. So, Peter Stein, I did want to ask you about sort of activism on the ground as this other sort of shaping factor, along with, you know, the city's topography, the technology that's available, the real estate speculators. How do you see that as sort of the, you know, grassroots or grass tops kind of activism shape in the city?
It's a great question. And again, one that we sort of discovered as we did more of the research that transit has become a battleground for questions of social equity. And we think, of course, of Rosa Parks being the symbol of what it means to sort of stand up for your right to ride. But we found this extraordinary story, for example, in the 1860s of a not so well-known African-American woman in San Francisco, Mary Ellen Pleasant, who 90 years before Rosa Parks actually sued a private trolley company because she'd been thrown off of actually not one, but two different streetcar lines. And she used the courts. Again, this is just in the years right after the Civil War had concluded in San Francisco to claim her right as a Black woman to freely move about the city. So transit becomes this kind of proving ground over and over again for what it means for citizens to be able to exercise their rights to move about a city. You mentioned
well, Peter, we have a cut from your documentary about Mary Ellen Pleasant, this African-American entrepreneur. One of the wildest things that the documentary points out is that she'd actually amassed quite an empire in early San Francisco, to the point where in today's dollars, she was able to send $1 million to John Brown, the radical abolitionist. A totally fascinating story. So let's listen in on historian Aaliyah Dunn Salahuddin on Pleasant's story.
This trial is significant for several reasons. One, she understands that her legitimacy as a Black woman in the 1860s in San Francisco is not really enough to win the case. And this is not even about the money for Mary Ellen Pleasant. It's about setting a legal precedent, understanding that this case would set the tone for civil rights in the Bay Area and across the nation. So this is very strategic on her part and a part of a larger assault against racial injustice in San Francisco.
Gary Camilla, I feel like I think of you as the person who knows like everything about San Francisco history. Did you know the Mary Ellen Pleasant story? And how can we get more recognition for this pretty remarkable bit of activism and entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I actually did know about this story. A good friend of mine, Allison Lovejoy, who's a wonderful pianist and composer, actually wrote a song based on Mary Ellen Pleasant's life and with, you know, referring to this episode. And I'd studied her a little bit. She's an extremely interesting figure, very controversial. But yeah, I mean, she deserves to be much better known because, as Peter said, this is groundbreaking stuff. 1866. I mean, this just wasn't happening. So she was an extraordinary human being and really deserves to be much better known.
Yeah.
If I can
Jeffrey
just quickly,
oops, oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Just quickly add sort of the kicker to her lawsuit. While the California courts basically ruled in her favor and said, yeah, they threw you off because you were Black and you can't do that. She actually was smart enough to try to sue for damages. Literally, the term emotional distress was used in her lawsuit. And originally, it was found in her favor. She was awarded $500 for the stress of being discriminated against. And what was unfortunate was that when the trolley companies appealed the decision up to the California Supreme Court, of course, then all white men, they said, well, yeah, you shouldn't have been thrown off, but we don't think those damages are appropriate. So we're going to just ask the trolley companies to refund your fare since you were not allowed to complete your ride. But no way is this special damages. And so it basically removed all the teeth from that ruling, and that wasn't rectified in California until 1893, and of course not rectified nationwide until the 1950s and 60s.
Wow. You know, Jeffrey Tumlin, Director of Transportation as FMTA, you know, you run this agency. So what's your relationship to people who are, for example, putting lots of pressure on you about particular bus lines or about the nature of the service that you're able to provide to citizens?
Well, the struggle with transportation in San Francisco is always about how do we provide the best possible service given our limited resources? And that is particularly true now as we face the worst financial crisis in our agency's history and a widening structural deficit. So we've been engaged in several months of intensive community engagement about how to prioritize what lines do we bring back first, and also how do we deal with the fact that travel behavior has changed dramatically as a result of COVID.
Yeah. You know, Peter Stein, want to talk a little bit about a slightly different kind of activism, the so-called freeway revolt. And why don't you just set up sort of what was happening in San Francisco such that citizens had to sort of band together to say, actually, maybe we don't want freeways running throughout the entire city.
Yeah, well, the whole nation was becoming infatuated with the automobile and the independence that granted. And all of transit planning in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s were all about making room in cities for the primacy of the automobile. And San Francisco and the transit planners built major bridges, which we love, coming into the city. And then in the, I think it was 1950 or 1951, revealed the transit ways plan, which basically was designed to bring suburban commuters swiftly and easily to all parts of the city, and revealed no fewer than 11 freeways planned to move across town, around the Embarcadero, through Glen Canyon Park, out the panhandle, you name it, every neighborhood was going to be faced with a towering above ground structure to bring cars in and out of the city's corners. And San Francisco was among the very first cities to spark essentially a grassroots revolt to say, we think this is going to wreck our neighborhood. And that was the beginning of the freeway revolt movement in the mid to late 50s.
Yeah. And then, you know, really seemed to get a lot of juice later on as freeways really started to come down.
Yes. First, there's the effort to simply block freeways, which did happen in the panhandle among activists there, and in Glen Park, which is the freeway revolt that we happen to cover in the film. A very different kind of movement has happened more recently, which is really trying to take a look at some of the inherent injustices, the inequities in a whole battery of transit planning, from where we've put freeways to where we've run light rail lines and commuter rail, because inevitably the communities with less voice, less power, BIPOC, poorer communities, have been subject to basically housing or being being overrun by the transit systems that serve wealthier and usually wider communities. And so what now has happened is that there's efforts to say we need to take these systems out, and it's a new way of thinking about how we move forward equitably. One of the big the great examples of that has been what happened with Loma Prieta earthquake, when the central freeway that ran right through Civic Center area was damaged, and Hayes Valley, which had been covered up and shattered, and anybody who was here before 1989 remembers both that and the Embarcadero Freeway as being, while for transit, very convenient, very sort of oppressive to the neighborhoods that they sliced through. And because of the earthquake damage, those freeways came down and quite literally sunlit these marvelous areas of San Francisco.
Yeah. Let's bring in caller Helen from San Carlos. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can, Helen. Go ahead.
Okay. Great. Thanks. I want want to speak to the comment that was just made about the freeways coming down. I have worked at the same job in Civic Center since 1986, and I lived in San Francisco when I got the job, but I later moved to San Carlos, and I've been a commuter for decades. And I used to take the Central Freeway, and it dropped me off at Golden Gate and Franklin, and I drove a half a block to my office. And so when that freeway came down after the 89 quake, I was disappointed, but what happened in Hayes Valley was truly remarkable. It really, really opened up the area. And the same thing, even more dramatically, happened when the Embarcadero Freeway came down, which I used occasionally to come from North Beach around to get onto the freeway to go home. And it had the most magnificent view of the Bay Bridge and the Bay and the East Bay, and it came down. And then that whole waterfront became like a European city. It just was a dramatic and remarkable change for the better. And I've always been like, oh, freeways are great to get to work, but they cause, blight in a lot of ways. So yeah, it was good they came down.
So you've come around on it then?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Helen from San Carlos. We're talking about the new documentary, Moving San Francisco, which premieres tonight, 9 p.m. on KQED-TV. It's about the city's past and present modes of transportation. We're joined by Peter Stein, co-director, producer, and writer of Moving San Francisco, Gary Camilla, host of Moving San Francisco, Jeffrey Tumlin, director of transportation with SFMTA. And I'd like to add Chanel Fletcher, the deputy executive officer of environmental justice with the California Air Resources Board, into our conversation. Welcome, Chanel.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So you're also in the documentary, and you have a great line where you say, like, you know, we can dismantle these systems that are doing things we don't want them to do in our neighborhood. So what are the other systems that when you look across the way that, you know, San Francisco and the Bay Area move around, like, what else should be dismantled?
That's a really great question. And I think one of the things that I would say, I think we've talked about freeways, that being kind of a system of oppression. I think this is a really important space to kind of almost pause and think about, well, who is the ones that are identifying and saying what is oppressive, right? Like, I think that's the point for me, is that depending on where you are and where you're at and what you're looking at, certain things can feel very oppressive, right? Like, I'm sure, for example, depending on how you get around and how you move, things like, you know, like Lyft or Uber, or even like when we talk about AV technology, that could bring the fears.
Autonomous vehicles, yeah.
Exactly, thank you. Autonomous vehicles, that can bring about that fear of like, well, wait, is this going to work for me? Is this meant for me? How is this going to benefit me? I mean, I think that's why in the documentary, I really talk about our bottom line. It just can't be, for example, you know, reducing GHG or greenhouse gas emissions, right? For example, for CARB, we really do think about, you know, climate change and GHG emissions, which are greenhouse gas emissions. And we think about how do we reduce those, but that can't be our only bottom line. We really do need to be thinking about equity, and we need to be clear and transparent about what equity is, because that's become a buzzword. So we've all heard about racial equity, gender equity, social equity. What are we talking about when we're talking about equity? What does that mean? And how does that then operationalize and shape what we are doing and what we are moving out? And so when we're looking at things through an equitable lens, then you can start to clearly identify, this could be oppressive to this community if we're not thinking about these different pieces here. This, on the other hand, could be very beneficial if we incorporate these pieces here. So I think I would just say that it's a big question to identify for like the Bay Area, right? Like what could be oppressive? And so I think that's where it comes into play of us really thinking about and talking about, what do we mean by equity? How do we have an equity lens? And how is that really in partnership with communities?
Yeah. Well, luckily we have Jeffrey Tumlin right here to ask, how do you interpret your role? How do you use an equity lens at SFMTA, particularly now, given that every transit system has been hit so hard by the pandemic? So now you've got to make hard decisions. You put the equity lens on, and what do you see?
Well, if the goal of public infrastructure is to make sure that everyone in the public has equal access to opportunity, equity forces us to ask the question, how do we correct for the disinvestment that transportation infrastructure has forced upon particularly communities of color, but also disabled people or children or the elderly? So during the pandemic, as we struggled with the loss of over half of Muni service, we also created a new transit line that was never there before, the 15 Bayview Hunters Point Express, which we co-designed with the Hunters Point community. Hunters Point is the only San Francisco neighborhood that has never had a one-seat ride to downtown San Francisco. And by fixing that, we quadrupled the number of career ladder jobs that are accessible in a 30-minute transit commute to Hunters Point residents. And we did this in collaboration with the community. This was their number one request in the Bayview community-based transportation plan. So equity is about engaging with community, finding out what people need, and then following through on your promises in order to equalize opportunity. Yeah.
Peter Stein, one of the points of your documentary, among many, seems to be that public agencies are accountable to the public in a way that, like, private companies like your Ubers, your Lyfts, or in the past, these sort of private streetcar companies just cannot produce equitable outcomes in the same way because they're not democratically accountable. Am I making too strong a version of this argument?
No. I think you've hit the nail on the head. One of the sort of revelations for me and for Jim Yeager making the film was, first of all, realizing that all of transit in the first 50, 60 years of the developed city of San Francisco were private. These were real estate, electricity companies, basically benefiting from the vertical integration and saying, oh yeah, we can run a streetcar line and we're gonna need to buy our electricity from us. And public accountability for transit and public ownership of transit as the sort of default assumption of what a city transit agency is, that started, that whole concept of municipally owned transit started in San Francisco in 1907 with the effort to compete against these private systems and have a city-owned, municipally owned transit system. San Francisco was like 30 years ahead of New York in municipalizing its transit. That said, now what's so interesting is that there's no way that public agencies can do all of this by themselves. And so the era of public-private partnership is that we're right in the middle of it. I mean, we just had Facebook, the company formerly Meta. Known as Facebook, invest $1 million into sort of R&D about what a, Southern Crossing Bridge might look like, because they, as a private, employer, needed to figure out how are our employees going to get to Menlo Park. And so there you've got a private company figuring out, should we build the bridge, which is really the private enterprise speculating into the public sector in a way that
shades of the Bay Area Council of the mid-century, though, too. Yeah, we're talking about the new documentary Moving San Francisco with the director, co-director, producer and writer, Peter Stein, Gary Camilla, who hosted it, Jeffrey Tumlin, director of transportation with SFMTA, and Chanel Fletcher, deputy executive officer of environmental justice at the California Air Resources Board. Broadcast premiere of Moving San Francisco is tonight, Monday, November 22nd. That's tonight, 9 p.m., KQED TV. And we do want to hear from you. What questions do you have about San Francisco transit history? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or the email is forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the new documentary, Moving San Francisco, with its co-director, Peter Stein, Toast, Gary Camilla, Jeffrey Tumlin, director of transportation at SFMTA, and Chanel Fletcher, deputy executive officer of environmental justice with California Air Resources Board. We have an awesome comment that I just wanted to read. Linda writes, "It is well within living memory that the cable cars would not allow women to ride on the outside. I must have been about 14 in the early 60s when the conductor told me that I could not ride there. It wouldn't have been so bad if he had found me a seat, but he just made me get off and left me behind." Gary Camilla, that's true, right?
I had not known that. That's pretty, that's, I mean, it doesn't totally surprise me. because that kind of retrograde thinking and behavior lasted a lot longer than we'd like to think it would. But I didn't actually know that particular fact. I will say there's a wonderful story that also involves, you know, equity for women on the cable car, which was on the very first day that the system operated, the franchise run, they call it. They had to, you know, make their first fare runs. And the cable, this is 1873, and they're crowded with men, of course. There's no women. And one woman just follows the cable car. She's like trying to get on. She can't get on. It's too crowded. Finally, some chivalrous men allow her to get on. She pulls out a nickel, puts it in the slot, and says, "Now for the rest of my life, I will know that I was the first woman to ride a cable car." So it's a kind of a sweet story on the other side of that. But that's quite disappointing that as recently as the early 60s, it was too dangerous for women to be on the outside of a cable car.
Yeah. Jeff Tomlin, do you know anything about this story by any chance?
I don't, although I do know that SFMTA board director Manny Cudial has been concerned about when he's riding around in a short skirt on his Vespa, whether that might be accused of engaging in unladylike behavior.
we get a couple other really, really interesting kind of, let's call it a potpourri of transit questions here. We've got Judd. Judd writes, "Years ago, my brother was in San Francisco on transportation business matters. We toured the amazing, mind-boggling cable car barn. I found out that the wood brakes were still in use and had to be changed out every 3 to 4 days. Is that still true, Gary Camilla?"
Oh, absolutely. That was probably one of the greatest day during the wonderful filming with Jim Yeager and Peter Stein's film, was the day that we went to the cable car barn. And the cable cars had not been running during COVID, and they took the cars out for us to film. And I got to ride with a wonderful gripman named Cedric, who like just told me everything he was doing second to second. I felt like I was in a Mississippi riverboat with Mark Twain. And he was just showing me that he's freewheeling now, he's not connected to the cable, when he picks up the cable. And then I asked him, what's that big lever? Is that the grip? And he goes, "Oh no, that's the brake." And I said, "Well, how does the brake work?" And he shows me that the brake is connected to a 2x4. It's like something you could get out of a wood scrap heap. And when you pull the lever, it physically presses down on the track. The friction of the 2x4 slows down the cable car, which is the most wonderfully low tech thing in a city like San Francisco imaginable. It's just it's a wondrously kind of absurdly old-fashioned device, and it works, and they do have to change them out all the time, and that's why you get that wonderful campfire smell when the cable cars are breaking.
I honestly, when I was watching the documentary, I was like, that cannot actually be true, but it's clearly true. That is, and it just speaks to that, the nature of that system as being developed in the 19th century. And hey, if it's not broke, why fix it? We want to bring in caller John from San Francisco into our conversation. Welcome, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good.
I have 3 points here. It's just like, one is the closure of the Market Streets. And I don't understand, when you close Market Street, where do you expect those cars to go? So now there is a lot of traffic on Mission Streets, and they're causing a lot of problems, wear and tears on Mission Streets. Besides, those merchants now are closing their stores because there is no cars coming through. And no pedestrians, people, I mean, it's like only a Muni and bicycles are on Market Streets now. The other point is, why are we closing some of the streets on the residential areas where 20% of San Francisco are disabled? They need to drive to get wherever they want to go, or maybe driven by a taxi or by a friend or loved one. Everything is being closed. I don't understand. When you close one street, that means there is another traffic problem from the one next from that, the one you closed. Thank you.
Hey, John, thank you so much. Jeffrey Tomlin, I feel like this one is for you. Let's go kind of in reverse order. Let's talk about the Slow Streets program first. And then we'll get to Market Street with you and Chanel.
So during COVID, San Francisco has implemented 45 miles, what we call slow streets. And these are, you know, low volume residential streets where we've asked that motor vehicles slow down and not travel, you know, through multiple blocks. But our slow streets welcome everyone. Everyone's welcome to drive on slow streets. You can walk and bike and you're expected to be able to walk in the middle of the street. None of them are closed to car traffic. But we ask that people be respectful of each other and share the street graciously. And it's resulted in about a 30% decrease in injury crashes on those streets and huge increases in walking and biking. They've also been enormously popular, over 70% popular on average and over 90% popular on some of our key corridors, which is arguably the most popular thing the SFMTA has ever done.
You know, Chanel, as we come to, we can include slow streets in this as well, but also the closure of Market Street and kind of this, some of the more radical maneuvers that we're trying to make to change the way that transportation works, to kind of move away from the status quo of essentially streets are for cars. One of the hardest things, it's like we know that in the near-ish future that we're going to be energy constrained, we're going to be carbon constrained, and we know that we can't be dependent on individual automobiles, electric or not, autonomous or not. And yet we're kind of, any change to the status quo also, as a caller John rightfully indicated, is going to disrupt things. So from your perspective, how do we kind of pull that climate-friendly future kind of closer to us? And how do we understand dealing with those with breaking the status quo and the problems that will come with it?
This is a great question. And I love what this caller was discussing, because I think we all feel frustration when change happens, right? So it's like, wait a second, I'm so used to taking this road to do this thing. And now you're changing it, you're disrupting it. What's the point? What's the purpose? And I think a previous caller had actually mentioned this. So I'm going to go back to her point where she had talked about, you know, I used to drive that freeway on Hayes Valley. I used to drive that freeway on the Embarcadero, right? And I was used to that. It made sense to me. You know, the commute, you know, it's fine. And then I think when they were removed, it was a shock, right? But then I think what we also saw, I mean, she literally said, it's like now you have this beautiful, like, European city in the middle of San Francisco that everyone can access, right? And I think it's the same thing for Hayes Valley. And so I think to me, it's always about pointing to the collective vision that we want to get to. And I think that is what is important here, is that I think exactly as Jeffrey had said, we have to remember that streets are not just meant for cars. And that sometimes I think is a shock in and of itself, but streets are meant for us to be walking. We're meant to be biking. We're meant to be moving. And when we have that collective vision that, okay, we're not just building these kind of like streets and these roads for us to drive on and for us to get to point A to point B, but for us actually to enjoy where we live, where we work, where we play, to actually take in, like, whether it's the waterfront, whether it's the playground. I mean, I think those are the things that everybody wants, right? Nobody wants to have a street where you drive like 50 miles an hour and you're scared to walk with your kids on it, right? So I just think that collective vision, that's what we point to: sustainability, equity. How do we all have access? And what does that look like and mean? And how do we shape that? I think that's something that we have to keep in mind as we're making these radical changes. And that's what we need to be sharing with the public, and know that, like, there probably will be frustration. And I think as we start to see the benefits of it, we're going to actually start to hearing people say, wow, I didn't think of it this way, but now I see it completely differently.
Yeah. Let's bring in Peter from San Francisco into the conversation. Welcome, Peter.
Yes. Thank you very much for this program. It sounds fascinating, especially how the neighborhoods bloom when the speed or the freeways go away. And we know speed kills from other discussions. So what's going on with Van Ness, which I think is a disaster? Everything has been made for supposedly for speed. Every single entry to public transit is going to have to be on an island in the middle of a very busy rapid highway, and then on top of it, they've got fast-moving traffic literally inches away from pedestrians right along the curb. So how do you justify that in terms of the benefits that presumably would be lost as the street becomes pedestrian highly unfriendly?
Yeah, thanks, Peter from San Francisco. Jeffrey Tumlin, I think this one's for you.
Yeah, so we're in the final stages of wrapping up the Van Ness Bus Rapid Transit Project. which delivers a fast, frequent, and reliable north-south transit line across San Francisco. And we will share that with Golden Gate Transit for connections on into Marin and Sonoma counties. So by moving the buses to the center, we get buses not only out of traffic, but away from cars that are queuing to turn right. So the Venice Project is really about transit prioritization. And of course, the boarding islands are in the center of the street, but because of our real-time information, pedestrians who don't want to wait on the island that's protected by steel barriers, they can continue to wait at the curb and then just cross when the bus is coming.
Yeah. Peter Stein, Gary Camilla, the co-director and host, respectively, of Moving San Francisco, which premieres tonight on KQED, 9 p.m. I wanted to get your take on, you know, what's the thing that documentarians in 30 years will look back on this era that we're in and they'll say, like, oh, that was really the thing that ended up shaping the city. Like, that change in transit led to changes X, Y, and Z in how this region works. Peter Stein, let's start with you, and then we'll go to you, Gary.
Oh, boy, you're asking me to prognosticate. I love looking backwards because it's already happened. I would say there are a couple of key developments that we're right in the middle of. It's a little hard to get perspective on how they will shape who we are. One of them is something that at least I in my neighborhood of Bernal Heights am aware of 12 times a day, which is the constant passing by of these autonomous vehicles that are mapping every corner and every obstacle and every sort of real-time incident so that, driverless vehicles can be going through the streets of San Francisco, which I think many people feel is oppressive and unwelcome. But I do think it's going to be a bit of an earthquake. Well, maybe that's the wrong term to use, but I think it will shape how things work in the Bay Area, possibly for better, possibly for worse. Certainly the convenience factor is huge, but it will likely cause a lot more traffic on the streets unless we find a way to make autonomous high passenger vehicles like autonomous buses and so forth available. So I think we might look back and say that, 2021, 2020, and next year are kind of the years where this, the autonomous vehicle presence in the streets of San Francisco became almost a fait accompli. I do think they're coming. It's not like we can turn that around. That's one key thing. And I'll just mention one other one, which is we need to solve the problem of 27 independent agencies in the Bay Area, all kind of competing for turf and having it be very difficult to make large scale collective decisions, as Chanel was pointing to, that for the public good, for the larger region. It's an extremely balkanized, bureaucratically encumbered set of agencies that we have here that make it very difficult to make big moves like bringing high-speed rail into San Francisco, or even building the Transbay Terminal so that it can accommodate all the modes of transit. It's a wonderful building, but it doesn't really serve all of the needs. So I think those two areas are really big.
Gary Camilla, what do you think?
Well, this might be more of a hope than a prognostication, but I'd like to see that the slow streets, in some cases closed streets movement, in combination with other urban developments, especially regarding zoning, with greater density, with transit-oriented development, we're in danger of having our cities becoming hollowed out, of them losing what makes them cities, losing their retail, losing their walkability. And I think that if you maximize the pedestrian elements of cities while also making them more dense, that creates more businesses, more walkability. It fights the Amazonification, if you will, of cities. But it all has to happen in concert with each other. If you simply have, closed streets, but you don't change the zoning patterns, then the cities are in danger of continuing to empty out and become non-cities, where everybody's ordering everything on phones remotely, which does not make it a city where people interact with each other. So I would say that combined with a combination of robust public transportation and, as Peter mentioned, you know, the driverless cars and even the Ubers and Lyfts, that model is clearly here to stay as well, and it has its place, but it needs to complement a far more robust public transit system and greater density in our cities. And then I think we'll hopefully make cities cities again.
Yeah. Jeffrey Tamlin, if you were politically unconstrained, what's a big change that you'd make at SFMTA or in our region generally?
So many changes. Well, I would regulate the public right-of-way for the public good. Right now, most of the basic street safety tools that work everywhere else in the world are illegal in California. Right now, because we Americans confuse our freedom with the freeness of mobility, we give the public right-of-way away to for-profit mobility companies that waste that space for the convenience of the privileged. I would argue that our democracy is dependent upon us all believing that we have something in common, that we have shared values. And the last great place for us to recognize our common humanity with our other city dwellers is on city sidewalks and on the public bus. We need to make sure that the public right-of-way is upheld as the public commons and the place where we all come together and as a refuge from the tribalism of social media.
Yeah. You know, Kathleen Commenter writes, just you know, a dissenting view on the Embarcadero Freeway. I've never actually heard this one. The removal of the waterfront freeway may have made a great community for residents and visitors and workers, but it destroyed one of the great views in the world from all except those with money to live in Waterview apartments or in Waterview offices. It was elitist. Of course, you could always go walk down there. It's a great place. We have been talking about the new documentary Moving San Francisco, about the city's past and present modes of transportation, with Jeffrey Tamlin, Director of Transportation with the SFMTA, Chanel Fletcher, Deputy Executive Officer of Environmental Justice with the California Air Resources Board, and two of the people deeply involved in the production of the documentary, Peter Stein, co-director, producer, and writer of Moving San Francisco, and Gary Camilla, host of Moving San Francisco, who's also the author of two great books, Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, and Spirits of San Francisco, Voyages Through the Unknown City. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Alexis. Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chanel. Just so you know, the broadcast premiere of Moving San Francisco tonight, 9 p.m. on KQED TV. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour ahead of Forum with Leslie McClurg.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.